This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
You are actually radioactive, and everything alive is.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Search for Unexpected Elements wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor'ı dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumya Ektay, The Fifth Floor, Farnak Amidi Sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. In 2021, the United States withdrew their troops from Afghanistan.
The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has insisted it is the right time to withdraw American troops from Afghanistan, 20 years after they first went in following the 9/11 attacks. President Biden is set to make the formal announcement in a few hours.
The decision to end the military lift operations at Kabul Airport was based on unanimous recommendation.
As the NATO forces in Afghanistan withdraw, the Taliban are gaining ground. They now control about a third of the country. Meanwhile, it's been confirmed that the U.S. military left Bagram Airfield, its key base in Afghanistan, without notifying the Afghans.
When the American troops pulled out, they left behind $7 billion worth of military supplies, including weapons and vehicles. The Taliban, who took control of the country in August 2021, got hold of this equipment. You can see it displayed in their military parades, but not all of it is in the hands of the Taliban. BBC Afghan's Hafizullah Maruf has found some of these supplies in a flea market in Kabul. Hafiz is here in the Fifth Floor studio with me. Welcome to the program, Hafizullah. It's great to have you again on the program.
Thank you.
So remind us of the context. What happened when the U.S. withdrew their troops from Afghanistan?
The U.S. Withdrawal from Afghanistan was very sudden. I remember I was reporting here for BBC Pashto in the Afghan services. Once they left, they have left massive amount of weapons, military vehicles, helicopter behind them. And now most of those military hardwares are with the Taliban. And some of them are rebuilt by them. But some of them, which were mostly in Kabul and also in Bagram, which is close to Kabul, most of those were destroyed by American forces when they were leaving.
Do we know what kind of equipment has been left behind?
In August last year, I was in Afghanistan, was reporting the third anniversary of the Taliban power in Afghanistan. I went to the biggest military airport, Bagram. I saw helicopters, tanks, a military vehicle, armored Humvee, which is costing more than $500,000 each one of them. And all of those military equipment was put on display when the Taliban leader were sitting on the same a runway which was used by American 3 years ago, and that was considered to be the most important airport for them in the country. Yes, and all those are with the Taliban now.
And they have things from, they have military equipment from other countries as well, don't they?
A lot of equipments were left from the Russian as well. Mm-hmm. So there was a Russia invasion in Afghanistan. So they had brought a lot of military equipment, including helicopters and massive ammunition from Russia to Afghanistan. So that's still there and they're still being used by the Taliban.
And you've visited kind of like a thrift market, a flea market for military equipment. I found it really fascinating. I've never seen anything like this.
The history is going back to 1980s when Russia invaded Afghanistan. They put the name of that bazaar, Brezhnev, which was the leader of Russia. Then later on, the Mujahideen who was fighting against Russian forces, they changed the name to Mujahideen Bazaar. Mm. After 2001, when America attacked Afghanistan and the Taliban government was collapsed, that bazaar again was named Bush Bazaar. The same bazaar was renamed Mujahideen by the Taliban deputy defense minister. I used to go there when I was there, a student of university in Afghanistan, because it's not only selling military equipment. You can buy uniform, clothes, shoes, and other things as well, sport clothes, because they're bringing from other countries. Most of them were taken from the American military camps. So it's an amazing bazaar showcasing the history of war and conflict of 50 years in Afghanistan.
That's
half
a good
century.
Point.
Exactly. It's a half century.
And it's just like any other bazaar, heckling and bargaining is happening. And you filmed the moment a Taliban fighter tries to bargain the price of some equipment with the shop owner. And we have a clip of that. Let's have a listen.
He was looking for a rifle scope for his gun. So rifle scope is a device that magnifies the target. Mm-hmm. So that's why the Taliban are so much interested in those kind of devices. When they were fighting against the Afghan forces in America in the last 20 years, most of the time they were using those rifle scope to target the military checkpoints and target the military guys inside their checkpoints in military camp as well. So that's why they are so much in love with these devices. Now, the thing is, most of those things are being replaced with Chinese. Because the Chinese are replacing the American, even military leftover in that bazaar.
It's going to soon be called the Beijing market.
Maybe.
But tell me, what are they saying in this clip?
So he were bargaining that to reduce the price of that equipment to him. And he said, look, in that shop, it was a bit cheaper. And here it is expensive. Why? And the shopkeeper is telling them, look, this is original Chinese. And that was fake Chinese. So that was the bargaining they was doing with the Taliban fighters.
So tell me, are these kind of negotiations common? It seems like it.
It is. It is negotiation is very common, but it is being tightened, controlled by, monitored by the Taliban as well.
So what are the Taliban fighters mostly interested in when they go to this market? What are they looking for?
The young generation, particularly the Taliban fighters, they are looking for decorative things in that bazaar and they are taking with themselves. But sometimes if you are a private security guy or even a Talib, if you have some sort of problem in your gun, you take that to those shops and they can fix it for you.
And are U.S. military equipment especially popular for them because they're more advanced?
Of course. The guy that you just played his clip, I asked him, so this is the gun that you hold, it is American. He said, it is now in our hand. It's not for them to use it anymore, but we like it.
You spoke to one of these sellers in the market, and he said something that I found very interesting. Let's play a clip. Hafizullah, what is he saying?
He was saying that he loved to have a shop selling female clothes, but he was somehow saying that I'm tired of war that we are having in our country, because he was like in the age of 35 to 40.
And he said,
yeah, and he was saying that I was born in the war, grew up in the war, but still it's not ended. But it's giving you a feeling that there is the entire nation are fed up and tired of being so much conflict in that country. I mean, his desire is very innocent.
Yeah,
of living
he just wanted to have a boutique.
Yeah, he just don't want to have a boutique. Not having a shop where he can sell the American leftovers.
Now, this military equipment is in the spotlight again because U.S. President Donald Trump has said that future donations to Afghanistan are conditional on the return of these equipment to America. Do you think that is going to happen? Is he going to get his equipment back?
I don't think so. It would be possible. I was speaking to some of the Taliban guys in those key figures were saying that it's never possible that we give them these weapons back to them. And he said this is, they call it their old word, ghanimat, or the things that you capture it from your enemy. So I'm not sure, and I don't think so that will happen unless they use their force. But it doesn't seem that Trump would be happy with that option because they just withdrew American forces from Afghanistan 3.5 years ago. I don't think so they would send their military forces again to Afghanistan.
Thank you very much. Hafizullah Maruf from BBC Afghan Service. Have you ever heard of the Afro-Brazilian dance, capoeira? Well, if you haven't, you'll learn all about it in just a minute. It's an absolutely stunning dance to watch and an absolutely difficult one to learn. Trust me, I've tried. My colleagues, João Felipe from BBC Brazil and Debula Kemoli from BBC Africa, worked together on a piece about the history of this dance, tracing back its origins from Rio de Janeiro to southern Angola. But first, let's hear João explaining what capoeira actually is.
Capoeira is at the same time a dance and a martial art. That's how most players see it. Some capoeira masters describe it as a kind of philosophy or even as an attitude towards the world. For instance, Master João Grande, he described capoeira as a thought.
A capoeira é o pensamento. A cabeça pensa, o corpo dá o recado.
Something that links the mind to the body. So a capoeira game normally involves two people facing each other, surrounded by other people in a circle. The two people playing capoeira would then move back and forth, eventually throwing kicks at each other, but almost never touching each other. Like in a choreographed dance, but always improvising. So rather than hitting the opponent, a skillful capoeira player would prefer to deceive them, to lead them into a situation in which they're caught off guard and almost hit. And by doing that, the player can show everyone around that if he or she wanted, they could have smashed his opponent's head, but decided not to. So when this happens, people around will normally laugh, react cheerfully. There's always music. People are clapping, singing. And people can also make acrobatic moves like flip jumps or handstands to show their skills. Capoeira is very fluid and very dynamic. A cheerful and friendly game can become tense very quickly. Just like things in life, right? So being able to make the right decision and remain calm under challenging and changing circumstances, that's a skill that a good capoeira player has, and that can certainly help anyone in their life. Like many people in Brazil, I first got in touch with capoeira as a child about 30 years ago. I watched this presentation at school, and I was completely amazed. And then took some classes, but never really managed to engage. Only a few years ago, 4 years ago, I actually joined a capoeira school and got more serious about it. So I'm still a beginner, but a very enthusiastic one. Here in Brazil, most people who practice capoeira live in working class neighborhoods. And many of them are black and have African ancestors. So capoeira still has this quite strong Afro-Brazilian element, although you can also find some middle class and even wealthy people who also are involved. So it is popular for sure. Everyone in Brazil knows what capoeira is.
Hi, my name is Debula Kemoli. I work for BBC Africa Digital. So I'm not as knowledgeable and experienced as you are on about capoeira, but in terms of its origins, from historical records and ethnomusicologists, they say that it originated from Angola. Obviously, capoeira, as we know it today, as a dance, a Brazilian dance, but the roots and the moves is traced back to a dance called Ngolo, which is from southern Angola. And how Ngolo got to Brazil is around the 16th century during the slave trade. So enslaved Africans who were transported from Central Africa to Brazil would then practice this dance as a form of resistance.
Capoeira was prohibited in Brazil for a very long time during slavery, until slavery was abolished in the late 19th century. Around 1950, capoeira became this symbol of national pride, so the government authorities were promoting it. And then in the 1970s, some capoeira masters from Brazil started to travel around the world making presentations. Some decided to stay in Europe, the United States, and they started teaching capoeira in those places. Eventually, Hollywood producers learned about it and invited masters to perform capoeira in movies. So then it reached a much larger audience. in the United States, particularly in New York, in the Bronx, where capoeira masters got involved in the 80s with the hip-hop movement.
A capoeira ajudou o breakdance, o relógio, que eles hoje fazem bem melhor do que nós.
We met a master who, in fact, he taught capoeira in schools in the Bronx, where black and Latino students were starting to practice breaking or breakdance. And many breaking athletes absorbed some capoeira moves, which also helped capoeira to expand abroad. Music is very, very important in capoeira. When two people are playing capoeira, people around are normally singing, clapping, and there's a group of people playing drums and the berimbau, which is a wooden instrument with a single string, and it's the music that determines the speed, the intensity of a capoeira game. So if the music is fast, the players play fast. If the music is slow, they play in slow motion, which can be even harder because it's not easy to throw a kick and leave your leg high up in the air for a few seconds.
In terms of the music, I think it has been easy for people, for instance, in East Africa to take up capoeira because some of the instrumentation is very similar to what we also have in our local communities, like the one-stringed instrument. In all our local communities, there's a similar one-stringed lyre, and the call and the response, and the drumming as well. So a lot of people can relate to that music. It's not very different to what they know from traditional music they grew up with. In Angola, ngolo, or a form of ngolo, was still being practiced by the Angolans. But in terms of capoeira now, I think it is early 2000s, the earliest record I have found of people practicing capoeira, you know, in the East African coast, for instance, in Zanzibar. I lived there for a year, I was working as a journalist there, and you'd see lots of young guys on the beach in white clothes. You'd go and ask, and they tell you, oh, we are doing capoeira. And it turns out it's somebody who has traveled to Brazil, has learned this martial art dance, and is bringing it back to Africa. So sort of Angola to Brazil and then back to Africa to people who've never heard of either ngolo or capoeira. For instance, even the history of the Angolan people now is becoming something that they are learning through capoeira.
I want to learn capoeira so that when someone attacks me, I can defend myself.
We went and filmed young people in a capoeira school in Kibera in Kenya. Kibera is a very poor neighborhood where issues like security are a real problem. So a lot of the young people there, while they're enjoying having fun learning capoeira, but also the self-defense thing is a real thing for them.
Maria acorda cedo todo dia e desce pra zona sul pra trabalhar.
So in Brazil, currently there's a bill being discussed in Congress to support old capoeira masters who face financial hardship. And if this bill passes, they will be granted a sort of pension.
A capoeira é um dos grandes tesouros, um grandes legados da cultura brasileira, não é? O Ministério da Cultura não.
Brazil's Minister of Culture also told me that they're considering including capoeira classes in public schools, which would make a huge impact both for students and masters. But it's interesting because capoeira is still frowned upon by many in Brazil who might not see capoeira itself as dangerous anymore, but still associate it with people who they see as dangerous. So class and racial tensions are very high in Brazil, and capoeira belongs to that universe. Capoeira helps many people in Brazil, not only me, learn about the struggles that Africans and their descendants faced in Brazil during slavery, but also how creative and skillful they were to resist and fight back. Slavery was horrific for centuries. Millions of Africans were captured, sent to Brazil. That's part of our history. But despite that, they were able to create something unique, something beautiful and powerful. They were able to create capoeira, which was also an excuse for getting together despite everything, to building a new community, having fun with friends, and also exploring the limits and joys of having a body and being able to move and jump.
João Filet from BBC Brazil and Debula Kemoli from BBC Africa. You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.
I'm Farnak Amidi, and this is The Fifth Floor, the show where I talk to the BBC's international correspondents about the stories they are working on. And no surprise there, our programmes are packed with names that I sometimes find quite difficult to pronounce. Luckily, there is a group of people here at the BBC who work behind the scenes to make sure I and other presenters don't get international words wrong. They are part of the BBC's pronunciation unit, and they sit in an office right next to ours. So I drop by to say hi.
Hello.
Hello, pronunciation unit. How are you guys? So, yes, can you both introduce yourselves and tell me if you speak any other languages other than English?
So my name's Jo Kim. I'm a pronunciation unit linguist. My first language is Korean, and then I speak English and French. A little bit of Mandarin Chinese, Japanese. I did operatic Italian at university, even though I wasn't an opera singer. I'm very interested in sort of all kinds of languages from Southeast Asia and South Asia.
Wow.
I'm Martha Figueroa Clark. I'm a pronunciation unit linguist, and my main languages are Spanish, Russian, and French, but we all dabble in lots of languages. So I speak Russian, but I specialise in all Slavic languages, and I speak Spanish, and I specialise in all varieties of Spanish, but also rear into other languages like Catalan. And then because of the Cyrillic, I also specialise in Greek. You know, it doesn't mean I speak all of those languages, but we all speak French, I think it's fair to say. Yeah, and have studied Portuguese and Dutch, and, you know, we've dabbled in lots of languages between us. So,
what is it you guys do here exactly?
So our remit at the BBC is to advise our broadcasters on the pronunciation of any word or phrase or name in any language for BBC programmes.
How do you go about making sure that it's the correct pronunciation?
First of all, researching the correct pronunciation. So what we want to first find out is how the pronunciation is in the native language. And then we have to think about how best we can anglicise that pronunciation for broadcasts in English.
And Martha, do you get help for your research from this amazing treasure of different journalists with different languages inside the BBC World Service?
Yes, we do really call upon lots of colleagues in the World Service, some of whom also might speak minority languages in the countries that they're from, or they might have contacts as well who we can then speak to. We also speak to academics, so they might be specialising in particular languages, or it might even be, because we don't always just do language research, it might be legal terms or zoological or botanical terms, so Latin terms, but how do the experts in those fields say those things in English? You know, sometimes it could be a mathematical theorem or something. So we have to be prepared to research any kind of pronunciation that might come up. It might be the name of a fighter jet that has a number in it. How do they say that in the army or, you know, the Air Force? You know, so anything that might come up in a program that they might not know how to pronounce, we have to be able to research.
Is there a particular word or a particular language that you have the most requests for?
That's a tough one. It really depends day to day, really. Say if there's a world event or a news event. If there's a war going somewhere, it might be that we're required to research a lot of languages in the regions where there is a major event. But I would say that we probably dealt with nearly every language in the world. But English is really tricky. English is really tricky sometimes. So So I think it's one of those ones where I think even native speakers find it quite tricky.
Really? Any specific words in English, for instance, that you can give us an example that even native speakers struggle pronouncing?
Well, it's not so much struggling, but like there are some languages in the world where a word is always pronounced the same way by nearly everyone. Mm. And there are some languages, like I'm going to say Arabic and English, where the same word can be pronounced slightly differently according to region or dialect or age. And so it might be that for English, for example, there are several correct pronunciations for the same word. So schedule, scone, scone.
Yeah.
They're all correct. But people feel quite strongly about whether their pronunciation is...
I've had that with scone. I say scone and I have an Irish friend who keeps correcting me, scone. And I'm like, no, scone is correct as well. He's like, no. So it's very interesting. Is there a world leader's name or a famous person's name that people really struggle to pronounce and they come to you?
Yeah, definitely. And our policy with people's names is to try and find out what their own pronunciation is. But the tricky thing with very high profile names or women's names is that often there can be a kind of an anglicization that forms that may not actually be based on their own pronunciation.
A really good one is Napoleon, where, you know, Napoleon isn't pronounced that way in French and it certainly wasn't pronounced that way in Corsican, but it's one of those names that's so established. And the argument is, if you did pronounce it in a more French-like way in an English language program or any of the languages that our broadcasters are broadcasting in across the world, would people know who you're talking about?
What's the best part about your work?
I personally think that when people are listening to a broadcast and don't notice that someone's mispronounced something, I think I've done my job.
Martha?
I think the other thing is just the variety for us as linguists. I think the variety of languages that we come into contact with, and we're constantly learning about the different languages and we might learn about different dialects. So, I think it's the variety of queries and languages that we get and the kind of programs that we get insights into. You know, I think we learn quite a lot through what we're doing.
But yeah, we're pronunciation detectives.
Definitely are.
Pronunciation detectives Martha Figueroa Clark and Joe Kim. I'm Farhanak Hamidi. The Fifth Floor team this week was
Alicia Joya
and
Caroline Ferguson.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
Science is done by people who constantly expect the unexpected.
That thing that we couldn't figure out, we figured it out. But now you're like, okay, this is like a whole other can of worms.
Unexpected Elements brings you the most unexpected bits.
At the origin of the lightning discharge, we have a temperature which is even higher than the surface of the sun.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service.
It's not Jurassic Park, is it?
It's Cretaceous Park. All of the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park came from the Cretaceous period.
Search for Unexpected Elements wherever you get your BBC podcasts.